So Jay, I want to ask you about another common argument that I get from Muslims, and I'm sure you do too. And the argument goes something like this. The Quran we have in our hand today is the Quran that Prophet Muhammad had.
Well, that's a big one here.
That is a big one.
Because the first thing I asked him, if the Quran, this Quran here, and this is it right here, this is the one you're talking about. Now, this is known as the Hafs Quran. Why? Because it was Hafs who was the one that wrote this. If this is the Quran that we have today, the response I would give very quickly is, then show me a manuscript of this Quran, because you are the ones that tell me that it is, you said, is the Quran we have today is the one that Muhammad had. So that means there's a textual history, not an oral history, because you're saying the Quran, that's a written book.
Yes.
A textual history that you can trace all the way back to Muhammad, who died in 632. Now, you, as a Muslim, let's say you're the Muslim, you know that 632 there was no Quran because Muhammad died without writing it down.
Correct.
Rather inept of him, I'd say. Nonetheless, Abu Bakr, who is the caliph that comes right after him, has his secretary, Zayd ibn Thabit, write that Quran down. And that was done in 632, 634. That was that two-year period. He writes it down, gives it to one of the wives of Muhammad called Hafsa. She puts it under her bed and leaves it there for 20 years. Let's now jump to 652. The third caliph, Uthman, is now in power. The other two have died off. We're 20 years later, and Uthman realizes that there's a multiplicity of Qurans. And so he gets Zayd ibn Thabit to get that one that was left under the bed. Rather odd that they would leave it under the bed and not make copies of it immediately. Yes. But he tells him to get that one that's left under the bed, to bring it out, and to rewrite the Quran. Now, why do you need to rewrite something if it's perfect, if it's complete, if it's not been changed? Right?
Right, you don't.
Now, everything I'm telling you comes from Al-Bukhari, volume 6, hadith number 509 and 510. So if any Muslim is going to question me, go back to Al-Bukhari, see if I'm correct. I'm summarizing it. I'm not reading it for you word by word. It'd take too long. So Zayd ibn Thabit takes this copy from Hafsa, takes it from her bed, gets it from her. He comes to the courts, the court there of Uthman, and he's about to start on this second task of rewriting the Quran when Uthman gives him three helpers. Alas, Zubair, and Hisham. So the three of them, along with Zayd ibn Thabit, so there's four of them. And Uthman realized that there might be a disagreement. So he says, if there's any disagreement between you, write it in the Quraishi dialect. Now, you speak Arabic.
Yes.
What's wrong with that right there? If you're writing in a dialect, if there's dialectical differences in the Arabic, orally, you can hear dialectical differences. How do you write dialectical differences in a written text?
Well, you don't. They are different words.
But how do you write it? How do you see it? How can you make sure that this is distinct in a written text?
You don't.
You can.
You can.
You need to have vowelization. Okay. You need to have the Dhamma, the Kasra, and the Fatha.
Okay, there you go.
The U, right. The E, and the A sound. Those are the three vowels that exist that create the different dialectical differences. Those did not exist in the 7th century. Look at any manuscript. If you look at any manuscript of any Quran, look at the Topkapi manuscript, look at the Ma'il manuscript, look at the Samarkand manuscript, look at the Husayni manuscript, look at the Petropolis manuscript, look at the Sana manuscript. Those are the six major manuscripts, and see if they have any vowelization. None of them do. Vowelizations were not invented until the 8th or 9th century. We're in the 7th century. We're in the early 8th century, actually, because these manuscripts don't even appear in the 7th century. So obviously, if you're going to write it in the greatest crazy dialect, that's the first problem. You can see immediately, Muslims are saying that they have a Quran that goes all the way to the very beginning. It's never been changed. Already, I've shown you a huge glaring mistake in just the narration. Now, once you have asked that question, show me a Quran that can be traced all the way back to 652, because that's the date we're looking for. I don't want a fragment. I don't want a piece of a Quran. I don't want a verse here and a verse there. I want an entire manuscript that is just like this book right here. I've asked Muslims now for, we're going on to 40 years. But we specially asked this in 2014 when I had my debate with Shabir Ali. I asked this of him. You say you have a textual history that goes all the way back to Uthman. Show me one manuscript. He could not come up with one. Because these six I've just named off, not one of them is from the 7th century. Not one of them, therefore, is from the time of Uthman. They only begin to appear during the time of Al-Walid in 705. Not one of them is complete. The Topkapi is the best amongst them. It's 99% complete. But it's actually the 2nd century AH, so it's after 719. It's possibly between 719 to 770. So you're talking about the mid to late 8th century. So don't even use that one. The Samarkand is early 8th century, but it only goes up to Surah 43. The Petropolis only has 25% of the Quran. The Husayni, we don't know because they haven't showed us how much of the Quran is. And we know that the Ma'ilun goes up to surah 43. There's 114 surahs. I'm asking for just one Quran that's 114 surahs that's from the time of Uthman, and we have yet to find it. So the Muslims have now put up on their website what they claim is the definitive answer to this question. If you go up on Islamic Awareness website, they will now say that they can come up with 96% of the Quran by 719. That means not 100%.
True.
And 719, Muhammad died in 632. The Quran was canonized in 652. So we're talking about still another 70 years later, they still haven't come up with 100%. But look at that 96%. What we found when we went to look and see what they meant by 96, they're looking at fragment here, a fragment here, a fragment here, and they put it together. They got 63 fragments of the Quran. 63. Now, we just looked at them last week. We just finally finished looking at all of the 63. Of the 63 we looked at, 29 of them are not from the 8th century at all. They're not from the, early 8th century. They're not from 719 at all. They're all long after 719. Most of them are tentatively. And so I'm fascinated that they make this claim. What's even worse, none of these 63 fragments have they looked at. They've not done any study on them. Can you imagine a Christian making a claim about the Bible and our manuscripts, making that kind of claim? We haven't even looked at the manuscripts to see if they even agree with the Bible that we have in our hand today? Well, Dr. Dan Brubaker has been looking at those fragments. He's been doing it since 2010. And he has looked at all the major manuscripts, and he has found 4,000 differences.
And you're talking those manuscripts that are put up on that website that you mentioned.
I'm talking about the manuscripts that anybody can look at, anyway. Go up on the website. Mm-hmm. Those 63 manuscripts, there's not one of them is a manuscript, really. We're talking about fragments. But they do not come from the first century AH. They do not come before 719. 29 of them, we already know, come after. The other ones are all tentative. We don't even know if any of them are in that time period. What is most damaging, when you look at all these differences, there are 4,000 differences. Take a look what kind of differences they are. Now remember, this is not the dottings. These are not the diacritical marks. This is not the vowelization. Those come much, much later. None of these have vowels or dots on them. This is the razm. You know what I mean by razm?
No.
The consonantal text. And when you look at them, there are hundreds upon hundreds of erasers. There are about hundreds and hundreds of insertions. Coverings where they've covered. There is one page of the Husseini manuscript that have 8 different coverings. And in every case that they, where they've covered it, where they've erased it, where they've inserted it, where they've taped over top of it, in every case when they've done this, they have standardized the text to this text that I have in my hand today. It's all been standardized to this text. So where did this text come from?
Right, that's the one.
Where did it come from?
Egypt.
Oh, when?
1920s.
1924, but it wasn't Egypt. It was just one city called Cairo. It was finally canonized in one city called Cairo by Nanmi Muhammad ibn al-Husseini al-Haddad. Great word, long and fancy. But al-Haddad chose one text. He chose out of 39 that he could have chosen from. There were 39 different Qurans that he had at his disposal. He only chose one called the Hafs. Hafs was written by a man that was died in 796 in Kufa. He could have, the other 38 all disagreed. In fact, we have 32 of them in London alone. In London, we now own 32 of these different Qurans. We've now looked at only 23 of them and have found 93,000 differences between them.
Where all these Qurans came from?
Well, they came from Jordan, they came from Morocco, they came from Yemen. You can get them in the marketplaces today. These are not hidden. These are quite transparent. But here's what's fascinating. That 1924, this one I have in my hand today, was only chosen for Cairo in 1924 because it was so successful having one Quran and not 39 different Qurans, they could have standardized tests in high schools. So Egypt made it Egypt-wise. They made it for the whole of Egypt in 1936. Because of the success of the Egyptian model, just for the country of Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, King Fahd decided to make it worldwide for every country all over the world that this book, the Hafs text, would be the standard for all the countries, and that was in 1985. How old are you, Jim?
59.
That means you're older than this Quran.
Yes.
Anybody that has been living since before 1985 is older than this Quran. This has only been standardized for the whole world in 1985. Now, let's come back to what I said about 5 minutes ago. I remember what Dan Brubaker found. He found all these different coverings and erasers, insertions. How do you know what to cover? How do you know what to erase? How do you know what to insert unless you have a standard to do so?
Right.
The standard that they're using to change all these corrections, these over 4,000 corrections, was only made canonized worldwide in 1985. So how can you have done any of these changes until 1985?
Yes. Now, I'm sure some of our Muslim friends say, Well, some of these copies you're looking at are just scribal error copies. I'm sure you've heard that, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you think about that?
Well, if it's a scribal error, then of course you have erasings and you have something over top. Mm-hmm. These are erasings with nothing over top. Mm-hmm. These are insertions above the line, and take a look at them. If I could give you an example of Dan Brubaker's book, no, I think it's example number 5. He has 9 different windows on there where the name Allah, the name of God, has been added in 9 different times on just one manuscript. Now, the question you need to ask is, why would they put Allah's name afterwards? Don't you think they know who Allah's name is?
Right.
Why is his name even needed? Because when you look at every one of those 9 instances, there's no need to have Allah's name there. It is understood they're talking about God. So why was Allah's name introduced at a later date?
I have no idea.
This has nothing to do with the scribal error.
Correct.
The reason they've done it is so that it parallels this text right here. Can you see that has nothing to do with a scribal error? Scribal errors, if that is the case, if you're saying a scribe forgot to do this and then wrote it in later date, take a look and you will see there are other ones that have actually diacritical marks and vowelization. Like bimithli has been put between 2 other words. Bimithli with the dots there. You don't have the dots there until the 9th and 10th century. So obviously you cannot have done this in the 8th century. So case after case, when they're saying these are scribal errors, none of these are scribal errors. They are standardized in the text.
What's the reaction to the average Muslim that you're sharing some of this new information about?
They're giving up Islam. We have found now, we know of 125 people just in around London who have given up Islam, have become Christians because of this new material. And the reason why is because we are destroying the foundations of Islam. Remember, Islam is only dependent on 2 things, mm-hmm. 1 book and 1 man.
Sure.
Here's the book, the man's Muhammad. If you confront the book, and you destroy it and say that this cannot have come from heaven, it could not have come from Muhammad, could not even come from Uthman. It looks like it was put together in 796 by a man named Huff, who was then chosen in 1924 for Cairo, and in 1936 for all of Egypt, and made worldwide in 1985. That means this is only a 34-year-old book, making me older than the Quran. What does that do to their faith? Suddenly they realize this is nothing more than made by man.
Absolutely.
See, you cannot do that in Islam. No Muslim can accept that this book is made by man, because it's uncreated.
True.
It has to remain uncreated. It cannot be open to any criticism. Now, when you take that from underneath them, when they realize that this didn't even exist, we don't have any manuscript that even supports it. In fact, I have yet to find a manuscript that supports the entire manuscript, the entire text. I don't know where it is. And I'm waiting for Muslims to show me. They can't. They haven't. So you can see how this destroys their faith. It destroys and disillusions them. But here's what I do. And I just don't want to leave them destroyed. I want to say, listen,
right,
don't worry about it. Come on back to this book.
Right.
Because this is a book that we don't have a problem with. We do not have this question. And that's the beauty of the Bible. The fact that we can give them the antidote, the fact that we can give them the alternative, that we never make these kind of claims that this book is eternal. Please don't make that claim. We would never make the claim that this book was sent down to one man. No, we know the authors that wrote it. We know that they wrote it in their own penmanship. We even give the names of the author and put them on the book, on many of them. And we know that this book was, though it was complete, and that we would make that claim. It was complete, but we don't have the originals. So there have been changes. We know it's been changed, and we warn the readers when the changes are there.
Right.
So we would never make the claims about the Bible that they have made about the Quran. We can now destroy those 4 claims about the Quran. And yet we come back to the Bible again and say, now let me ask you something, Jim. Is this the only word of God we have? No, it's not. We have another even greater word of God, the Logos. The word of God who took on flesh, right, and dwelt among us. His name is Jesus Christ. Now let's ask the 4 questions that they support about their Quran, about their Word of God. Let's ask them of Jesus Christ. Is Jesus Christ eternal? Yes, he is. Was Jesus Christ sent down? Yes, he was. Is he complete? Absolutely. Has he never changed? Of course he's never changed. So the very 4 things they claim about their Quran, we have pretty much destroyed that in the last 5 minutes. But we don't make that claim about our Bible, but we do make that claim about Jesus Christ. Everything they're looking for, we got in Jesus Christ. Just come on home.
Yes. No, I think that's really good what you did by show the errors and the problems and the pedigree of this Quranic manuscript. And it just doesn't exist.
No.
But we don't leave it there. Right? We move to, we have an answer for you.
We have to move there. See, the atheists come up to me and they say, "Wow, I love your argument." I say, "Well, please don't use these arguments because I don't want you to destroy the Quran."
No.
Because you have nothing to give them.
Yeah, right. They have nothing to offer.
Come on home. We need to bring them. That's right. This is really, this is a Christian polemic.
Yes.
And this is something we need to be at the forefront of. Because as Christians, we do not believe that this is the Word of God.
Absolutely.
And thank God that they now, the historians and all the linguists and all the experts have now pretty much destroyed this. But we don't want them to be destroyed. Because I don't want Muslims to be flailing.
No.
I want to bring them home. I want to bring them a bigger and better book. That's why I keep this bigger for that reason.
That's right. Good. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for that explanation.